Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast Archives, Film Directing. In this podcast, we go into our back catalog to find the best interviews, conversations, and episodes to help you understand the craft of film directing. And before we get started, I want to let you know that I've put together a free masterclass on directing action sequences on a low budget. All you need to do is head over to indiefilmhustle.com/free course to gain access to this free mini masterclass. That's indiefilmhustle.com/free course.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. I want to introduce our guest today, which is an extremely talented, wonderful, not only actress, but human being, Jenica Bergier. Jenica is in the movie This Is Meg. She and I worked together many, many, many years ago, and she's good friends with Jilly, and I wanted her in This Is Meg so badly. And she is a industry veteran who's played so many different amazing parts. And you know, she's been in recently. She was in Shameless, a nice character arc in the Showtime show Shameless. Bosch on Amazon. She was in The Trophy Wife, as well as Safety Not Guaranteed, Chasing the Mavericks, Modern Family, Seinfeld, Friends with Benefits, and of course, This Is Meg, as well as so many other shows. And she's very famously known for being on The Drew Carey Show, where she played Drew's girlfriend, her handywoman character, which she was beloved, and she was on a few seasons of The Drew Carey Show as well. So she is just a comic, in many ways, I feel like she's an improv and comic genius. I've worked with her now twice, and she's brought so much amazing stuff to This Is Meg that I wanted to bring her on, and also just kind of talk to her a little bit about her career, how she's made it in the film business, and she's also a director. She directed last year her first feature film, which was a micro-budget feature film, very similar to This Is Megan as far as budget's concerned, and it's called Come See Me, and it is just a fun movie, and I talk to her a lot about how she made that movie, how she kept it under $10,000. She got the cast, obviously, and how she shot it, and the trials and tribulations she went through in distribution, and still going through because it's only probably about 6 months, 8 months, and she released the movie. So without any further ado, please enjoy my hilarious conversation with the amazing Jenica Bergier. Jenica, thank you so much for taking out the time to be on the show today. Thank you so, so much.
Does anybody ever say, it's not my pleasure?
No, you're the first, so thank you for that. So for people who don't know, Jenica is very pregnant, as you like to put it.
I'm very pregnant. I've been pregnant, very pregnant for the last 3 years, essentially.
Exactly. And it's one of the main reasons we cast you.
Which was so exciting because nobody's casting me this time around with my pregnancy. With my last two pregnancies, I worked a ton.
Did you really?
But this pregnancy, I haven't. Other than This Is Meg, no one's checking for me.
Well, you know, it's just great production value. And I don't know if you saw it on our Facebook that we actually put up. I think the first picture we put up of you, I'm like, yeah, it cost us $1,000 to get it to look like that.
I did see that.
The makeup was amazing. And you had no idea how many people like, wow, that's a really great makeup job.
That's a really great belly.
It's a great belly. I mean, how did you do that? I'm like,
I love how you put her double chin in. That was amazing.
That's all
you
post.
Airbrushed her double chin.
That's all post. That's Photoshop. That's all Photoshop. Mm. So, Jenica, I wanted to ask you a bunch of questions because I adore you. You know I adore you.
And I was so excited when you guys called and said you want you went away and then you came back with Indie Film Hustle, which is so you, which is so great.
Thank you so much. And for the audience to know, me and Jenica worked on a project six, 7 years ago, I think now. And it was called
It was very funny.
It was Zombie Marriage Counseling. which was funny. You were the counselor. And that's where I fell in love with you at that day. That day that we shot, I was just like, oh my God, I have to work with her again. And then of course I don't call you for 6 years.
We had like babies to make and olive oil to
brew. I was in my dark, deep black hole and you were making babies. So, but I'm glad we were able to jump on this one, but we'll get into this as Megan a little bit. But first, what was your first job in the business?
Well, my first job in the business was, I was like 3 years old. My mom was at Ralph's in Van Nuys Boulevard. And somebody said they were a casting director and that I would be cute in this commercial. Mm-hmm. And it was a GE commercial. Of course, I don't remember it. And my co-star was Drew Barrymore.
No.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
And that was before E.T. So, my mom was equally as crazy as Drew Barrymore's mom, and they stayed friends. And they stayed friends. I would imagine if there was texting back then, they would have continued to text, but because there wasn't, mm-hmm. They couldn't maintain their crazy relationship. So
got it.
So that was like the first thing, and that was, I guess you could call it a discovery at a
very young age.
Very young age. It turns out I was just an extra on that, and Drew Barrymore was the lead on that, which would make sense and why she was Gertie. And then I did like a bunch of commercials when I was a kid, but nothing significant. They were all sort of non-union. And then I did one commercial. You see the back of my head, and I got my SAG card.
Okay.
I told my mom, I don't ever want to do this again. I hate show business. I want to stay at school.
Wow. That's
but I really only wanted to stay at school, not to study, just for the social aspect, because mm-hmm. I just wanted to see my friends. I had a boyfriend. He had a Ghostbusters t-shirt. His name was Shane. He was super cute. And then my other boyfriend, Jermaine Warner, we had a little breakdancing club. I couldn't fit show business into my social schedule.
Right, of course.
But my mom continued to pay my SAG dues. But when I realized I wanted to pursue it, I was in high school, my senior year, and you know when, I don't know if you ever had this in your high school, but a person comes and does like an infomercial basically for memorization, mm-hmm. and they set it up in the gym and they explain like these tools for memorization.
Yeah, I remember all that stuff.
Remember
yeah.
this?
Yeah, yeah.
So the guy came, they set up the microphone, and the guy was late, and we were all just sitting there in the auditorium or gym. And I, my friend was like, go do some stand up. And I was like, all right. So I got up and I did Eddie Murphy's whole act.
From Delirious or from Raw?
Delirious. Okay. Delirious. Okay. Of course. Raw was okay. Delirious was, you know, the bomb.
Yeah, of course.
And then a big brown shot came. And then, from that point on, my theater teacher was like, I think you should pursue this. I was like, really? Okay, I have a SAG card. And she's like, that's half the battle. So at that time, I was in Palm Springs, came to Los Angeles, got a job at a coffee house called Insomnia, mm-hmm. which was popular. And a producer came in. Her name was Lisa. And she produced a show for VH1 called Naked Cafe. And they wanted people to improvise. And I got my first job.
And I read somewhere in your bio that you worked with Russell Simmons. He was kind of like, he kind of discovered you in a sense.
Exactly. So I kept doing stand up. I was really bad at it. But I was really young and bold. So people were interested, but I really had nothing to say. Mm-hmm. And Russell was like, you crazy white girl. I like you. I like you. He came to a show.
Okay.
And he was like, I started this company with Simmons, Lathan, Brilstein Gray. And Brilstein Gray is the other half. That's the white side. We the black side. We have Def Jam Comics. I think you should be on the black side. So I was the only white female comic on the black side of the Def Jam Comics.
Right.
And that opened up opportunities for everything I did. I was auditioned for SNL. I was 19 years old. They got me an audition. I flew to New York. I auditioned in front of Conan O'Brien, Dennis Miller. They were in the audience just randomly.
Right.
Didn't get it. Molly Shannon did.
But you're friends with Molly now. You've worked with her. many times.
Yes. She did us a favor and did my movie many, many years later. But cool. Because we shared a limo ride back from our hotel, mm-hmm. We both didn't get SNL, and we knew by the time we were going to the plane.
Right.
And I was crying in the car. I'm 19. And she's like, why are you crying? I'm almost 40.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And so, then she got it.
So then you've done a lot of stand-up, obviously, in your career. Now, how has that prepared you for being an actress? Or has it?
The only thing that's prepared is the leather skin that I developed, just from so many times bombing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's brutal. I mean, I what you and Jilly and all any stand up, it's like it is so hard to go up front of a stage with a mic and make people laugh for a consistent amount of time. Like you might get one joke, but to do a set, like even a 5-minute set, it's like an eternity. So these guys like that do an hour and a half, and it's got people rolling for that long. I mean, oh God. And you also met Jilly doing stand-up, correct?
Yeah. Well, actually Jilly was the only female comic I've ever met that was nice. And I met her at the Ice House, which I'll call for the sake of the story, the Nice House. I think the thing we had in common is that I knew that she was a good actress. And so there wasn't a level, it's weird. It's like almost like somebody who's done theater, you know, you can be a part of an ensemble, and stand up is very, singular.
Yep.
And,
there's literally a spotlight on you.
Is literally a spotlight. So, so we just remained friends, but, I realized eventually with stand up for me is it wasn't the best form for what I had to say as an artist. It didn't exercise all of my muscles and my talents. And I was trying to, just get attention, I think, on stage. And that's not a good reason to do stand up. I remember opening for Rodney Dangerfield, and it was a pivotal moment for me because I realized that he's the guy who didn't get respect, and he had to tell you that. That's where his funny came from. He really didn't get respect. Mm-hmm. And he's this, you know, he was this dopey fat guy, and it rang true. What I had to say, I probably had not enough life experience at the time, and I found that it's better to translate my material through first a one-woman show, then a TV show, and then a movie.
Got it. So that's where you kind of started leaning more on being an actress than anything.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'll go back to stand up. It is such a grind.
Oh, I know. I know, Jilly. I mean, I've worked with a bunch of stand ups in my day, you know, as a director, and I've seen it firsthand. You know, I've been on like a little tour where there's, you know, 10,000 people one night. And I've been in the comedy club, you know, when there's, you know, five people. And it's a grind. It's like you've got to – it's one thing to be the funny guy at the party. It's another thing to make a profession at making people laugh. It's very, very difficult. And also cutthroat.
It's cutthroat, but it really is truly a gift. Like I don't think I am gifted in that way. I think I'm fearless, mm-hmm. and that's what made me stand out. But – and I had breasts, and that was unusual. but ultimately, you really have to be driven to do it. Just like you really have to be driven to be a politician. You have to really be driven to have that spotlight that's just you.
Right. Right.
And I couldn't hack it once I had my first daughter. Mm-hmm. Of my 19 children that I have.
Yes, I see you're Amish. It's nice. It's very, very nice that you obviously Roman Catholic. No, I'm joking.
half Catholic, half Jewish. Both are coincidentally horny. So.
And obviously no television in the house at all, ever.
Ever. bored as fuck, literally.
So.
So once I had my first kid, I was like, I can't do this. I can't be like hanging out with the dude that's been working on a joke for 2 years at a coffee house trying to get my material right. It's just not going to happen.
Got it. Yeah, your priorities changed and yes. Things become clear. This has happened. It happens to all of us. I agree with you 100%. Now, when you're working with a director, what do you look for in a good director and a good collaborator?
Well, first, what is their vision for the project? Okay. The best directors I've worked for have dreamt of what they're doing. I have worked with so many technical directors who are amazing visually and do not know how to speak to a human being.
Yes.
I've worked with great directors who were actors, who really know how to work with actors, but, you know, don't know anything technically. Mm-hmm. I think one of the best directors I worked with was Colin Trevorrow, who directed Safety Not Guaranteed. And it's not a shock that he was essentially scouted as a mini-me by Steven Spielberg for Jurassic World, because he, from the moment I met him, it was so dear to him to tell this story. He knew every single part of the film and how he wanted to tell it. Mm-hmm. And so he had, you know, some of the technical side, but he also had the heart of the story, and he had collaborated with the writer of the story, which Derek Connolly, who wrote it, who was amazing and had a great idea. And he wanted it to be special right down to the music. So
if you guys haven't seen that movie, it is so much fun. And it is such a dear movie, like you say. There's a lot of heart in Safety Not Guaranteed.
Yeah, and I'm really grateful to be a part of it. He was one of the best directors I ever worked with. I've gotten to work with Curtis Hanson, mm-hmm. who was amazing because when I met with him, I'm doing this really dramatic scene playing an alcoholic mother who's getting beaten by her husband and who just wants the best for her son, but she doesn't have enough self-esteem and has to work at Kmart. I mean, really high stakes, and did this great scene and really just talked to my acting coach before I went in and really gave myself permission to go there and dark place. And after I was done, he said, looked at my resume, he looked up and he said, what was it like to work with Helen Mirren? And I realized, like, for working with him, I mean, he's done amazing movies.
Of course.
For him, it wasn't about the indulgent performance or anything like that. It was like, who was the person? And I said, what was great about Helen, because she directed me in a short film that was actually nominated with a series of short films mm-hmm. for Oscar. A lot of people don't know that. What was great about working with her was she was just like me, an insecure actress. She said, you know, I am famous in my native land, but here it's very hard for Americans to adopt me. It's very hard for them to.
What are you talking about, Helen? We love you.
Right. But she was, that's what I'm saying. That's what was so amazing, was that she was just an insecure actress like me. And that made Curtis laugh. And then I got another part in the movie.
Oh, nice. Yep. It's amazing. You know what's amazing about this business? It has, yes, talent is important. Experience is important. But it's so, like, it's almost like so random sometimes. A funny story could get you a part or get your part extended, which can lead to somebody else looking at that part and go, oh, well, let me cast her. And then boom, 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 and you're in Jurassic World. Like, it's, you know, there's a lot of work that has to happen, but I think it's just, you got to kind of be in the game for things to happen, I guess. But once you're in the game,
well, you do, and you also have to know your, I think that the internet changed things completely for me auditioning. I could really see somebody's material before I went in. I could really know about them, read about them, know their personal life, what kind of toilet paper they used mm-hmm. and everything before I went in. I could almost be a stalker before I auditioned.
Almost.
But like, there's a difference between auditioning for TV shows, which is really frustrating, and the director is out of that process. Mm-hmm. They'll be in the room. They don't have a say.
It's the EP. Right?
And no.
Who's the decision maker? Oh, the studio.
No, no. That's the ultimate decision. The producer, the creator of the show uh-huh. is who you're auditioning for. The writer, creator, producer, sometimes a non-writing producer if that producer likes you, you have to go to network to be approved. The director is completely just literally in the same position you are.
Hired hand.
Hired hand. There is no, I've auditioned for directors that I've worked with who love me, who I've known.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
For a TV show, and they have no say in it whatsoever. It is about the creator of that TV show and the network's relationship with that creator. And that's a really frustrating place to be, because there are several times that I've gone in and two times something was written for me, mm-hmm. and I don't get the job.
Seriously?
I've even seen in casting breakdowns a Jenica Berger type and not gotten an audition.
Why? How has that happened?
Because there's 30 people making a decision for television.
As opposed to film, a feature film, it's a lot less.
Well, there's studio and then there's indie. So indie film could literally, quite literally, be four people, which would be which is the amazing side mm-hmm. thing. That's why I wanted to make an independent film, because it was a reaction to a television show that I made. I wrote a one-woman show for the purpose of selling a TV show instead of doing stand-up. Mm-hmm. I invited everybody in show business. They came. ABC, CBS, Fox, everybody was interested. I went around with a showrunner. We pitched. Fox passed. ABC passed. CBS passed. Nickelodeon bought it for Nick at Night.
Okay.
They said, we buy it with one stipulation. Jenica doesn't get to star in it.
Are you kidding me?
No. So we said, okay, we developed it. It was developed in my life, but based on my life, my experience of my husband being a chef who cooks for celebrities and I want to be one. It's Lucy and Desi in a restaurant. Okay. And my best friend character is like the Ethel. She works for the city as a crisis responder. So she has access to planes, trains, and automobiles, because she knows the fire department, the police department, and everything. Uh-huh. So we're always trying to bust into these parties and work where my husband is. And at the end of the day, it was all about raising my daughter True. Uh-huh. Because it's the only way I know how is to act.
Right.
They love the story.
Sounds wonderful. It sounds like a great show.
Right?
Yeah.
They love the story. They did not love. It's not that they didn't love me. They were very clear. We're trying to make something of ourselves for our network, Nick at Night. And we want a name. And that's how it's going to go. Mm-hmm. So we developed the show. And we had a script that they really liked, but it wasn't getting greenlit. So my non-writing producer decided to produce a pilot presentation and pay for it. And we did it to prove that I could star in my own show. And Jill played my best friend.
Right.
And we promptly proved that I couldn't star in my own show.
Why?
Because so much control was taken away from me. It became about, even in the indie experience of creating a pilot presentation, there were three non-writing producers, one showrunner, one writer's assistant who became a writer on the show and became a creator on the show, me writing, a casting director who was helping us, another producer who came on to line produce. There was so many opinions, let alone I can't talk. Why? Oh, see. Yes. What? No, thank you. My husband likes to interrupt me.
I see that.
He's like, oh, there she is talking about herself again.
So I'm on Indie Film Hustle. Please leave me alone.
Please leave me alone. I have a bigger fish to fry.
So you can't, you didn't, you, so there's so many people, there's so many chefs in the kitchen. No pun intended.
In the kitchen. And as a reaction to everybody saying this didn't work, the network saying it didn't work, my people saying it didn't work, my agent saying nobody should see this if you want to save your idea, which, by the way, nobody's helped me with the idea since. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten the script back. No one should see this. As a reaction to that, I wrote, come see me. Mm-hmm. I said, I want to just take two cameras. I want to shoot 6 days. And this is what I want to do. And I met two producers who would help me do that. Keith Carville at Unified Pictures, mm-hmm. and he helped me because he saw the show and he said, you're right, it isn't good. It isn't what I know of you. Let me help you make what you want to make.
How cool. Now, this is the micro-budget feature film that you directed.
That I directed. And I wasn't even planning on – it's not like I set out in the world to direct. Mm-hmm. I was like – I was encouraged by both him and James Portalacy, who came along and helped me make a $10,000 budget. Mm-hmm. And my friend Mary Verneuil, who cast it and produced it. I was encouraged by all of them to direct it because it was my story. For a while, I wasn't going to direct it. Somebody else was. And then it was like, no, that's what went wrong with the TV show. I'm trying to tell a story. I need to be able to tell it the way I need, whether it's good or bad, I need to be able to tell it.
Right.
And I co-wrote it with my friend Doc Pedroli, who's actually a way better writer than me and helped me structure it in a way that made it a film.
And what did you shoot on? Do you remember the cameras?
Canon HD7.
Okay. All right. So you shot with
two. Yes. And he begged me, my DP, Peter Moseman, begged me not to use those. He begged me for the Blackmagic. Mm-hmm. We had in the budget $900 for cameras. We had two free cameras, so we used the $900 for pretty lenses.
And just like I haven't called you, you didn't call me.
true.
So it's fair, I think, at this point, because yeah. I would have been more than happy to help you out with anything.
Oh my God. That would have been amazing.
Yeah. I would have been more than happy to help you in the post, all that kind of stuff. But now we're working on this as Meg, but we'll get to that in a second. So tell me the Come See Me, that was scripted or a little bit non-scripted as well?
It was both. It was about 46 pages for the whole feature.
So it's definitely a little bit of improv there.
Yeah, definitely improv in between. What I knew was what I wanted from the scenes, mm-hmm. and we would put five beats to the scenes, and there were very specific descriptions of what I needed that were between me and the DP mm-hmm. for the script, and Doc very elegantly doctored it, literally, and made it legible for everybody in the cast to read mm-hmm. instead right. of my crazy. And then the mom's like, fuck you. And the sister's like, you're good. he made it a little more appealing. Mm-hmm. We ended up improvising within those confines of the scenes, but we knew where we were going to shoot. We knew our locations. We had it all mapped out, and all the cast members had a Bible that I had written that was about 20 pages about who this family was, so that they had that to work with.
Got it.
And in most cases, the best lines in the movie came from people improvising, not something I had written. And I wanted to have this organic experience with actors because I had had such a non-organic experience of telling my life. When I did the TV show,
right.
of trying to hit jokes and lines and it not working and it not being like the real Josh, and this great actor, Joshua Funk, who's an improviser, played my husband, and we just knew each other. So mm-hmm. it just really worked. We really seemed like a couple. And he also had to commit to, because I wanted to give birth in the film, because I was actually... Because I was 9 months.
Your method director.
I'm a method director. I was 9 months or 7 months pregnant when we filmed it, and we knew that we had one day left, and it was the day to give birth, and everybody was on call. And Josh, who played my husband Josh, uh-huh. the one requirement, when I talked to him, I said, how do you feel about being in the delivery room and pretending to be my husband with my real husband there and my kid and stuff like that? And he said, I think it would be fun.
And your husband's just off camera.
Well, what we did was we ended up delivering the baby uh-huh. and using the footage from the camera. And I talked my OBGYN into having labor and delivery for 15 minutes. They left the room. My real family left the room. Uh-huh. My fake family came in.
And your OBGYN did the scene?
We used his stuff from the footage we used in the hospital room. Very minimal footage. Obviously, I didn't want to show a bloody mess. So we used him delivering and the baby being weighed and the baby coming out and the baby being put on my chest. And it was actually one of my most proud directing moments ever, because the whole crew was standing outside. The sound, my AD, my DP, and my friends who were in the movie.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I said, and James Portalacy, who produced, and I gave birth, and they all came in and they were like, okay, how's this going to go? And Tawny Katane was supposed to be in the scene, and she was stuck in traffic texting me while I'm giving birth. Can you just wait? And I was like, no. I'm dilated. It's happening. Oh, but I'm almost there. She literally arrived 20 minutes after the baby was born. And we only had labor and delivery for 15 minutes. So Josh came in and the AD said, okay, we shot a bunch of stuff in the hallway and we think it goes, you know, scream, scream, scream. And then we come up on your face. And I said, no. That is not how childbirth is. Josh is here. He's videoing it. The baby's just been born. Mm-hmm. The scene takes place after the baby's just been born. Okay. Set the camera up and you'll have to see it when you see the scene.
Yeah.
It looks like they were actually there.
Oh my God. Well, obviously this is something I can never do as a director. So
you will never have that luxury. I'm sorry.
I will never give birth.
No, but you could be invited. Actually, you could. I'm pregnant. If you want to use it in a Ruby scene, we can.
I appreciate it.
I'm willing. I'm that kind of vagina.
I understand. I understand. You are fearless. There's no question about it. You are one of the most fearless actresses I've ever worked with. So, yes, without question. Now, on some technical stuff, when you were finished with Come See Me, how did you get it out into the world? How did you get it distributed? How did distributors feel about it? You know, how did it go?
Well, like any indie filmmaker, I made a movie for Sundance.
Yes, of course. We all do. Meg is being submitted, of course.
When I got I literally just made it for Sundance. I had no plan outside of that.
Oh, really? So you were like just the lottery ticket. That was it.
Just it. This is it. And I thought, I'm literally betting 10,000. We spent 10,000. We're betting 10,000 and a childbirth on Sundance. And then I'll never forget the 6 a.m. email I got. That was the standard email you get, mm-hmm. because my other friend had submitted her film and she certainly thought hers was going to Sundance too.
Right.
And we're both on the toilet, I think, at 6 a.m. texting each other, and we received the same email that seems personal but isn't personal.
Right.
And I was just floored. I mean, I had no backup plan. There was no backup plan. Wow. And luckily, James Portalacy had a backup plan. He had always thought that we should just go straight to distributors. And I said, well, I kind of just made it to tell the story. And he was like, well, I kind of made it so people could see it. So
that's great. You're like the prototypical artist. Like, I just wanted to tell the story. I could make money doing this.
I literally was Golly G. Willikers. And he had produced my friend Lance Kinsey's film. That's an improvised movie that I'm in as well. Mm-hmm. Right before this movie. Mm-hmm. And Lance said to him, let me be very clear, James, I made this movie to make money. But I made the movie for the story.
Mm-hmm. For the art.
For the art. I did. Uh-huh. And then I realized that the one gratifying artistic market place didn't accept it. I didn't have a backup plan. Luckily, it got into New Filmmakers LA.
Yeah, I love
which was
those guys.
A great festival.
Amazing. They're wonderful.
And it had gotten in before Sundance, and they said, "Well, let us know if you don't get in." And I was like, ah, yeah.
As they chuckled.
Exactly, and I was like, "Yeah, well, whatever. It's going to get in." And I immediately called them and said it's available. And then a great festival called First Time Fest in New York. Mm-hmm. Loved it. And it was in competition with six films. And the people who looked at the film were Martin Scorsese, Harvey Weinstein. And then Harvey Weinstein came and spoke to us filmmakers at the festival. That was a great festival. And then it continued to go on to like 12 more festivals, women in film. It won best screenplay three times, which is hilarious.
Because you improvised a lot.
Because it's a 46-page script.
Right,
But I attribute those awards to Doc Pedroli for making it – making my crazy legible and palpable. And then randomly, we never had a distributor screening, and we did not meet distributors at festivals. James emailed The Orchard, which is a big distributor, and they exclusively distribute Duplass films. And she wrote back in a month or so and said, I love the film, and we'd love to release it a worldwide digital distribution.
Okay.
So it went on Amazon, iTunes, On Demand, Virgin America Airlines, which was exciting. And they're currently in negotiation for some kind of broadcast that we're hoping that we get. And it just was released on DVD May 15th.
How cool is that? So
yeah.
Has it made any money back? Can you?
No, not a dollar. Not a dollar.
Not even a cent.
Not even a cent.
So a $10,000 movie has yet to make a profit.
We keep getting guaranteed that we will make a profit.
You have to. I mean, that you got to.
What I feel good about is that I know how to make a movie for that little. That's what I feel good about. What I walked away from is, okay, I didn't get into Sundance. I didn't break out as the newest, amazing, innovative director who uses her life story in all her stories.
You're like Precious, but different.
Exactly. not that different at this point. But once that didn't happen, I realized what I do know how to do is support art, support indie filmmaking. And I went on to support my best friend who made her film, and she successfully crowdfunded for $50,000. I didn't want to crowdfund because I'm too nervous to ask for money.
Tell me about
it. But I let her ask for it, and she's finished. That film is almost finished.
Oh, great.
And, you know, projects like This Is Meg, I'm absolutely rooting for, because it's born of, I would like to take some control and I have something to say, which is a little bit of to go back to stand-up, which is a little bit of why we started stand-up. It's like, I have something to say. I'm here. I'm different. I have something to say. Let me get on stage. Hopefully we can have some fun tonight. But at the end of the day, most stand-ups, no matter how much they have to say, most stand-ups want a TV show and want to be Seinfeld.
Well, yeah, because after he got the first check when it went into reruns.
Exactly.
Was it $300 million? Was something like that.
Something bananas. And I still get residuals from my episode of Seinfeld, so.
I'm sure.
I can imagine.
What he gets.
Exactly.
Or what any of the main cast gets.
Exactly.
So since you brought Meg up, let's talk about a little bit about This Is Meg. So you get a call from Jilly, and do you know the how this whole project came to be?
I do. It's very similar to me. She went through a pilot season that was hell, and you called her and said, I want to do something. Let's get your friends together and do this. And she was like, I'm tired of being treated like crap. I want to do my own thing.
Right.
Too.
And I called her up and I said, Jill, I want to make a movie. I want you to be the star of it. And I want to talk about your experiences as an actress and a stand-up in L.A., being a female and not being 20 years old. Let's do something real. And like, let's call everybody up. But by the way, Jenica, the first words out of my mouth, I'm like, and Jenica has to be in it.
She told me that.
That was like one of the first – I'm like, and Jenica has to be in. So you, even though I hadn't called you, you were always in the back of my head. I'm like, I need Jenica. I don't care what we do. Jenica has to come in the movie.
Oh,
so I
well, that made
you.
I was happy that you were involved. She said, "The gang is back together again," is basically what she said. And I was like, I'm in, whatever. What do you want me to do?
I haven't actually.
Want me to give birth?
I haven't. I know she called. Like, we cast the movie in 3 days.
That's so rad.
She just calls everybody up and she's like, I'm making a movie. She's like, everyone basically said, yeah, let's go do it. What do you need? And it was so wonderful to see how fast everything got off the ground. Now, and obviously you jumped on the train because of your relationship with her and wanting to work with me. Can you talk a little bit about Ruby and your experience bringing her to life?
Well, it's funny because she wanted me to play this sort of retired actress who's claiming to be retired on purpose because she's happily married with a bunch of kids. Mm-hmm. And when she first said that, I was like, oh, I know how to play this because I'm not retired, but I have a bunch of kids and I know how to be a mom.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
What was different was that she's...
You have to be a bad mom.
Meg works for her and she keeps her on as a nanny, which is something very LA. And the nanny, Meg, never meets the children.
Right.
She's really basically supposed to be a paid friend.
Right.
And
she's
I
the backup
know these,
nanny. She's the backup nanny.
She's the backup nanny. And I know these women. My daughter has gone to preschool with these women. And it was very difficult for me to tap into because... The operative word that actually got me centered in playing the character, improvising, was be a bitch.
Yes.
And I never really get to be a bitch. Mm-hmm. But everybody has an inner bitch. And
even
that
guys,
bitch came
even
out.
Guys have inner bitches.
Even guys have it. Oh, that's for sure. I think guys are more in touch with their inner bitch than girls. You know, we don't really want to rear its ugly head. But once I could, for me, working on a character, I always have to get the costume and the makeup right. Mm-hmm. And not in a vain way. It's like, what am I wearing? Like I text her like 5 times, like, can we discuss what I'm wearing? I want to wear a kimono.
Yes.
I was like, I need a kimono. I'm also pregnant, grotesquely pregnant. I feel hideous, but this is a girl who was an actress. Mm-hmm. So she's obviously has some sort of vanity. Mm-hmm. And I'm not that kind of vain actress. So I had to put myself in the shoes of somebody who gets facials and takes care of themselves.
Yes, of course.
That was different. My idea of a facial is splashing water on my face. Right. So that was really fun. But once in the scene... First of all, Jill and I have worked together and a lot. Mm-hmm. So I've always called upon her to play my best friend in things. Mm-hmm. And so that was really easy. And I like her so much. So it was really hard for me to be a bitch to her. But again, once she gave me the license to do that.
Oh, you went for it.
It was great.
You went for it.
Yeah. And you're so supportive. And if I don't get you to laugh, then I'm not funny.
Yes, true. That's very true. And many times I giggled quietly as the scene went on.
Yeah. So it was just a really fun experience.
It was, wasn't it? We had a really good
time.
I
mean, I want to do it again.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how we can bring
you back. Ruby's birth.
I'm trying to think of how we can bring you back.
Ruby's birth.
I think the birth. I think we're going to bring...
I'm going to just keep... I want... Because how is... Just think about it from this angle. How is the kid that I filmed the movie of giving birth to... And by the way, my oldest daughter wrote the song in the movie that was nominated for an award. She was 10 years old and she wrote a song on guitar that was nominated. Aww. So that was commemorated in the movie. How do you think this baby's going to feel if you don't commemorate her birth on your film?
We'll have you as the end credit sequence of bonus. After
that
the credits
Ruby
are
calls,
done.
Ruby
the...
calls Meg and is like, you need to have this baby for me. You need to pull it out.
Meg, wherever you are, please just come. Please
just
come.
Just come.
Now. I'll triple your pay. I need you to pull this out. I'm so tired of these babies. We had such a good time. And when with this project specifically, you know, I've kind of really wanted to work with people who are very seasoned, like yourself and Carlos and our cast. Pretty much everybody in the cast is
well, Mo Collins and Deborah are
Mo and Deborah and all the
funniest women I've ever seen perform.
So funny.
Ever.
I can't wait to do our scene together in a few weeks. But I kind of given license to like, okay, like this is kind of like my experiment in a way too, because I was like, okay, well, Jenica, what's Ruby Fight like? You know, let's talk it and like, let's just kind of make her up as we go along. So there's, I don't have a very preconceived, I have an idea of where I want to go with the story, obviously, but like things like I want to wear a kimono. I'm like, that's brilliant. You know, I feel a lot of times, you know, you hire an actor and they should be responsible for their character. They shouldn't just be a movable prop.
Well, that to the point of micro budget, micro indie filmmaking is on a large budget with great artists who are being paid. Absolutely. Their opinions are all a part of, and you don't have as much collaboration, but on an indie project, as far as being an actor, what was so awesome about on Come See Me was Karen Landry, who played the mom, just brought it. Like, I was like, she needs to look like she has no teeth. How are we going to do that? I mean, she contorted her face in such a way. We put latex on her face to make her more wrinkled. Uh-huh. And we just put this costume together and she was down. She was down and in that costume for 4 days in a car. Like, and then there's Tawny, who is wild and has an amazing body. And, right. And I needed to access that, use it. And she had like the most incredible wardrobe I've ever seen. And to bring that stuff mm-hmm. is different than having a high paid person who's bringing their artistic vision, which is not to take away from it, because I've worked with some amazing customers.
Oh no, absolutely. Like, I mean, if you're working on a bigger budget film, but it's all depending on the kind of story you're trying to tell and the kind of movie you're trying to make. You know, obviously if you want to win, you know, if you're going to have an Oscar winner, like I worked once with the wardrobe stylist from Sex and the City.
You know, oh, she's amazing.
I mean, she was amazing. And I worked with her for a week on a project, and my God, I mean, she's a genius. You know?
Patricia, right?
I forgot her name.
Patricia Fields.
Trisha Fields. Yes, exactly. And she was wonderful, and I learned so much from working with her. And, you know, but it was just like, you want to work with the best of the best. Like, you want to hire an Oscar-winning DP, you know, but on this movie, I'm lighting it purely because this is the kind of story I'm trying to tell and things like that. So it's just really... by the way, I don't know if you had this experience, but when you try to explain what you're doing to people, they look at you with a tilted head like you're crazy.
And they also don't believe the price point. Like, no, when you does. Say for 15, they're like, yeah, you no. can't do that.
No.
Yes, you can.
It's beyond their comprehension. It's not like Robert Rodriguez didn't make El Mariachi for $7,000. Like, they just couldn't grasp that. Like, they didn't make any sense. Like, you know, oh, how much did Paranormal Activity cost? That's not possible. Like, they don't get that. And in today's world, more than even back then, it's so much more possible to do it now if you have the right people with the right skill set and the right equipment.
Exactly. Well, when I would say one tip for micro-budget filmmaking is get seasoned actors.
Yes.
And seasoned people who have worked on film, or if not seasoned, then willing. Willing to just show up.
Well, those are the two sides of the spectrum there, Jenica. She's like, you really need to work with season. If not, just anybody who will work. Anyone who will just show up and be a body.
But it's true.
Yeah,
it's
like to a certain extent.
They just have to be willing to want to like make something. There are a lot of people who come out of school mm-hmm. entitled. I have met so many, at least actors, mm-hmm. who are like, oh, but I have a BFA. But I have an MFA. And I'm like, well, that has nothing to do with auditioning.
Nothing.
That has nothing to do with somebody else's project.
Yep. That's why, you know, I called it Indie Film Hustle for a reason. You know, you have to hustle. And no amount of schooling or degrees means anything. It's all, you know, like I always tell people, like, you know, Max Spielberg might get meetings and he might get some projects set up. But if he doesn't deliver the goods, you don't care what the last name is.
True.
You know, at the end of the day, that might open the nepotism will open the doors for you, but it won't keep you there. You know, that's my experience.
Well, I've never had nepotism, so
yeah, I know,
I don't even know what the experience would be.
God, wouldn't that be nice that you get like, yeah, I worked with your dad on that Oscar winning movie. Why don't you come in? Let's talk about your project.
I'm finding it's less and less on every set. I'm finding that with this generation, with Kickstarter and Seed and Spark and Indiegogo, mm-hmm. that there are less and less nepotistic artists and actually hungry people who have something they want to say and do.
Absolutely.
That's what's really cool. I'm still afraid to put my foot in the ring for fundraising for a project. I'm still trying to do micro budget on a studio level.
That's what we're trying to do with This Is Meg. Exactly. A micro budget, but it looks insane for the budget that it is.
That's because you know how to shoot.
I hope. I hope when it's all said and done, everyone will agree with you. So I wanted to talk real quick about one of your most famous parts, which is the Drew Carey Show. Can you talk a little bit about that experience? Because that must have been so much fun playing that character.
Well, I have one great story. I mean, I don't know if it's great, but one exciting story of my whole career. Uh-huh.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I played his girlfriend, Sharon, the handy woman, and they wanted to do an episode at the Cleveland Browns Stadium.
Okay.
So we flew to Cleveland for the Drew Carey Show, which mm-hmm. was not unusual for the members, for the regular cast members on Drew Carey, because they'd film all those great dance opening sequences and stuff there. Mm-hmm. But it was exciting for me, and I had no idea what to expect. In Los Angeles, oh, you're on the Drew Carey Show. Oh, you work at Warner Brothers. Oh, yeah. In the traffic suck from Venice to Pass Avenue. I mean, that's about the extent of the conversation. And I remember not being able to be seen for a show that I was right for, because the casting director said, well, isn't she on the Drew Carey Show? She's fat, right? And I was, let me tell you, triple tinier than I am now, at uh-huh. least 90 pounds less. That's not an exaggeration.
Okay.
So that was my experience of being on the Drew Carey Show in Los Angeles. Step outside of Los Angeles into Ohio,
uh-huh.
and it was like I was Priscilla Presley.
Oh, really? It's like Beyonce walked in.
I had no idea. I had no idea what to expect. And they were saying, what's your alias at the hotel? And I was like, what's an alias? I didn't get it.
Right.
Like, what's your name going to be? Because they were so famous in Ohio.
Really?
And you don't experience that in Los Angeles. I'm a working actor. I mean, I was discovered at Ralph's when I was 3 years old.
It's just a part of the business. It's
just part of the business.
Here. Yeah.
So we walk up to the Cleveland Brown Stadium for rehearsal. Uh-huh. This is just rehearsal day. We weren't even shooting.
Uh-huh.
And people are like, Sharon, which is my character's name. Sharon, like 35,000 extras showed up.
No.
Or maybe it was 13,500. Maybe I have the numbers wrong, but it was
over
a lot of damn people.
Over
10,000 people. And they were like, Sharon, I was like, oh my God, this is the power of syndicated television. And you know what? The great thing about Drew is he never, ever took it in. He never once thought, I'm the shit. He never once acted that way. To the day of the show ending, he wasn't quite sure if he was good enough to be Drew Carey. And in one way that was sad, and in one way it was actually endearing and charming. And what made him special is because he really just did not have an ego.
Right.
And he was that guy, that sort of lovable guy that you see on the show. Mm-hmm. So that was a cool experience. And then, they nominated me for an Emmy for the Tool belt dance striptease that I did.
Nice.
But the Emmy, the Academy did not, or whatever they are, Motion Picture
Association.
So thank you. They didn't recognize my genius.
Obviously. I think you and Ruby have that in common.
Well, I could draw from that. Yeah.
Yes. There's a line. You're like, I was nominated, but you know, that was rigged. I didn't believe that.
Well, it probably came from that. Actually, from that experience.
I'm sure it did. So I know you're very pregnant, and I know that this is, you know, you've spent way too much time on the show already. So I'm going to ask you a few questions left, and and then I'll let you go and rest. What is the advice you can give any aspiring stand-up or actor trying to break into the business?
However you're going to do it, what you have to say about your life and your experience is the important part. So find the medium to do that and gather a bunch of friends and tell it. Great. If that means stand up, then gather a bunch of friends on the road and go and tell your story. That means if a TV show, perform it as a one-person show, or get people together to film it yourself, and same with the movie. That's my advice. Waiting for an agent or manager to discover you doesn't happen anymore. There's no discovery. There's no door. You are the door, essentially.
That's great advice. Very, very great advice. Now, what was the lesson?
Actually, and let me go back. Uh-huh. My father said, if you want to go be an artist, because he was a jazz drummer who pretty much when he passed away died penniless, mm-hmm. being a jazz drummer. Mm-hmm. And he had worked with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Clifford Brown and Dexter Gordon.
The greats.
And he basically died penniless. So he knew what an artist meant. Right. And he said, Jen, if you want to be an artist, then go do it. Go discover all the arts. Enjoy paintings at museums. Go take dance class. Go sing. Go get on a set. Go help. Go lift some lights. He said, do it all. Don't just try to, you know, be famous. So I love that he gave me that that advice, because I've had that attitude my whole career. I'm not going to just do stand up and commercials. I'm going to do stand up commercials, television, film. And if they won't hire me, then I'm going to make it.
Because now you can. Now it's much more accessible.
Exactly.
30 years ago, you have to shoot 35 millimeter and it's going to cost you $100,000 just to come on the set.
Yeah. Now you can.
So what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, either in the business or in life?
I think I'm still learning it. I think the lesson I'm still learning is that that hard work doesn't necessarily pay off. That you could just do a great job and you still can't stand with your hat out, because it doesn't matter. That hard work doesn't necessarily pay off. Hard work is just hard work. So go do what you love and focus on your family. I guess that's the lesson I learned. That's probably why I keep having children, because I'm invested in my relationship with my husband, who seems to want to breed all the time. And at the end of the day, I know that having a family is the most important for me. And with having said that, I still am not giving up on my dreams and my ideas of what I have to tell. I'm just incorporating it.
Right. Because at the end of the day, when the spotlight fades, you know, and it fades on everyone, the people that you've built around you and your family being the closest people to you, is what's important. And that's something I've learned in the short time I've been around as well.
Yeah,
with my family. So it's not always
cute ones too.
Oh, thank you so much.
You also probably learned this too. It's better if your kids are cute.
Well, there's always depends. You know, they're gonna be they're my girls are a little too cute, and I'm afraid about what's gonna happen when they get older.
Well, that's a man thing.
That's a completely man thing to say. But
as a woman on the playground, I'm like, my kids are cuter than yours.
They are cute.
Maybe that's the stand up in me. I'm like, my fucking kids rock.
So, what are your three favorite films of all time? Whichever films that kind of come to your mind right now.
Well, I'm embarrassed, but not embarrassed to say, mm-hmm. Safety Not Guaranteed.
That's a great movie.
The moment I read that script, I was like, I have to be in this movie. And I actually was testing for a series that same day, and I kind of screwed up the test so that I could be there on time to audition. Uh-huh. And even though it was not lucrative to make that decision, I knew it was a special movie. Just the script alone, mm-hmm. I wanted to be in it. That's one of my favorite movies. E.T.
Okay.
To this day, I recall waiting online to see
too.
It.
Yep, me too.
On off of Van Nuys Boulevard at the theater there, and then waiting again to see it. And Breakfast Club.
Oh, great movie.
There's a little John Hughes in me. There's something about that. It's not all of his movies are great, mm-hmm. but there was something about what he captured about all their relationships that mm-hmm. I can't let go of. I mean, I still think back to that movie at least once a day.
But that movie is also, it was made in the 80s, but it's completely relevant today. Completely.
Totally. Because of the relationships, because of the characters.
And the archetypes. Like those archetypes, we all grew up with all those archetypes.
Absolutely. It's, and there's, I mean, that and Ferris Bueller, those are the, I would say are, you know, if I could make a movie be that good, if I could write a movie that good, then I would feel like I arrived or I did something. It still is like, you know, there are masterpieces in the world, like Out of Africa.
Sure.
You know,
Blade Runner. Yeah, I mean, there's some.
Right. Yeah. Those are masterpieces. And, but that I, as a actor and as an artist, I always refer back to those John Hughes movies.
Mm-hmm. And they're the masterpieces of his genre.
Exactly.
Without question. I real quick, I want to ask you, did you get a chance to work with Mark Duplass at all? Or
yeah,
with
not. I didn't work with him. No, I didn't actually. We didn't have any scenes together.
Okay,
but I got to work with him in terms of the press of the movie and going to Sundance and be with him. And he's really super cool. And I've gotten to speak with him and his.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Producer Stephanie Langhoff a lot since.
Oh, cool.
He's somebody to look to. He's just great.
Yeah, for everybody who doesn't, I've mentioned him on the show before, but if you guys haven't heard or haven't seen any of his work, Mark Duplass is kind of like an inspiration to
all of us.
To all of us as indie filmmakers, but also like for non-scripted, and also even though he actually writes his movies. But he completely throws the script out the window once he's on set, is what I heard.
Yeah, I mean, he a lot of his movies are improvised, mm-hmm. But they have an outline. Right. And but Safety Not Guaranteed was not that. It was not improvised. It was written.
It was written. Was there any improv? I mean, I'm sure anytime you're with him, he has to improvise something.
Not in our scenes. Not in my stuff with Jake Johnson. Okay. He didn't improvise, and they were very specific about the words. They weren't like saying don't improvise. It was just very clear it wasn't an improvised movie.
Like say your lines. Say the lines exactly as they're written.
Yeah. I mean, nobody said say your lines exactly as they're written, but you didn't come to the set going, this is going to be mumblecore and we're going to see where this goes. Colin really knew what he wanted and so did Derek, and they were working hand in hand to tell. They had, as you can see in the movie, they were very specific in the vision of what they wanted.
And Mark is actually the one who helped get that movie made.
It wouldn't have been made without Mark. They have a mutual agent or manager or something, gave it to Mark. And they said, Mark said, if I'm the dude who puts out the ad, the classified ad, then I'll give you money. And he brought on Big Beach.
Nice. That's awesome. He helps a lot of indie filmmakers out. He produces a lot.
Oh yeah. I mean, he produces so much. I haven't used the Mark Duplass card, and I haven't even shown him Come See Me, or I don't even know if he knows about it. But,
well, you should probably reach out to Mark.
I, you know what? So many people are reaching out to him and wanting so much from him. I did reach out to him about Togetherness because I have a sister theme in my film. Mm-hmm. That is very relevant to the TV show Togetherness, and I auditioned for it, and he wrote back a very sweet email, can't wait to see your tape, mm-hmm. blah, 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 and I didn't get it. So that was about the extent of me asking for his help. But if there's a project, I think he's also an incredible actor, and so is his brother. Uh-huh. So I thought he was amazing in Hump Day. I mean, he blew my mind in Hump Day.
I loved Your Sister's Sister. I thought that was wonderful. I love that movie.
And Lynn Shelton is we were in Safety Not Guaranteed too, and I didn't get to meet her because she wasn't at Sundance, but I'm a huge fan. And for the very reason of, it's similar to John Hughes in that there's relationships that are archetypes that are amazing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No question. Now, let me ask you, where can people find you?
JennicaBergere.com. Mm-hmm. Jennica Bergere on Facebook, mm-hmm. Jennica Bergere on Twitter, Jennica Bergere on Instagram. I made it real simple.
Okay, so that's where everyone could find you. So
I have about 2 followers.
I know. I've noticed Alex, we're trying to get those followers up for you. We're doing the best we can.
Alex Frodati and Jill Michelle Million. Yeah. Those are my followers.
Exactly. Jenica, thank you so much for taking out the time. I really appreciate it. And I cannot wait to show you the scenes I've been editing, your scene, and show you the final movie when it's all said and done. Thank you for so much for being a part of it.
Has any guest ever said, I love you?
No, you'd be the first.
I'll be the first. I love you.
Thank you so much. Love you too, my dear. As you can tell, Jenica and I had a lot of fun, not only in this interview, but you can only imagine the kind of fun we had shooting her scenes in This Is Meg with Jilly. They're pretty hilarious. I can't tell you. I've been editing them recently. Actually, just yesterday, I was editing that whole scene, parts of her scenes, and I was on the floor. It's really, really funny and really real. And in this movie, Jenica is fearless. And when I say fearless, you'll have to watch the movie to understand how fearless of a woman and of an actress she really is. So from the bottom of my heart, Jenica, I say thank you so much for bringing your amazing energy to This Is Meg. And guys, don't forget to please check out the Indie Film Syndicate, which is my indie film kind of hub membership community, where you can get access to all of our online courses, as well as exclusive access to how we're making This Is Meg. It's kind of called a micro budget film masterclass. So it's pretty amazing, and I really love you guys to take a look at it. It's at indiefilmsyndicate.com, and if you want to donate to the This Is Meg campaign, you can, and get discounts on getting into the membership. And we've already started uploading a ton of stuff of what we've been doing, and I'll be continue to upload monthly as we go from soup to nuts, all the way from how we got the LLC formed, all the way to how we're distributing the movie, either self-distributing it or getting it distributed by a major distributor. So check that out, indiefilmsyndicate.com. And as always, head over to filmmakingpodcast.com and leave us a great review, hopefully, for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Today's show is also sponsored by Enigma Elements. As filmmakers, we're always looking for ways to level up production value of our projects and speed up our workflow. This is why I created Enigma Elements, your one-stop shop for film grains, color grading LUTs, vintage analog textures like VHS and CRT images, smoke, fog textures, DaVinci Resolve presets, and much more. After working as an editor, colorist, post, and VFX supervisor for almost 30 years, I know what film creatives need to level up their projects. Check out EnigmaElements.com and use the coupon code IFH10 to get 10% off your order. I'll be adding new elements all the time. Again, that's Enigma, E-N-I-G-M-A, Elements.com. So guys, thank you so much for listening. I hope you got a lot out of this episode. And keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's I-N-D-I-E-F-I-L-M-H-U-S-T-L-E.com.